You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, should older, potentially offensive books be revised to remain relevant or left alone in favor of fresher works? We'll talk to a historian and former teacher about new revised editions of books by Roald Dahl and Ian Fleming. Think James and the Giant Peach and James Bond. Now, what's the secret to a good borscht or awesome dumplings? It's Food Friday, and our guest today is sharing some of the recipes that she grew up with in Ukraine. Her new cookbook has turned into a cause. She's sharing a celebration of Ukrainian culture while raising funds to help feed people living through the war. Our next guest says, in Ukraine, life happens in the kitchen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about Ukrainian cuisine? What are some of your favorite foods from Eastern Europe? Did you grow up eating Ukrainian food? Love to hear your favorites, your stories at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Anna Voloshina is a Ukrainian-American chef and author of the new cookbook, Budmo, Recipes from a Ukrainian Kitchen. Anna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us, Budmo, what does that mean in English?
So budmo, it translates to let us be, but we use it as cheers. So it's a very cheerful word. And when we drink something, we always say budmo. And that means let us be together, let us enjoy this moment, and let us celebrate life.
What made you decide to write this cookbook and share these recipes, many of which you grew up with?
So first of all, there are not a lot of Ukrainian cookbooks. And I saw that when people were eating my food, they were like, oh, my God, I would totally cook it at home. And I thought, maybe I need to write a book. And my publisher was thrilled with the idea, and they said, go for it. I wrote it, and I wanted to write a book about the other way of living, the other way of eating, something I grew up in, Ukrainian relationships to food and to culinary culture. So it's just something different, and I think that the United States were ready for this.
And before we get to the food itself, can you talk about how you're hoping to use your work and Ukrainian food to support people in Ukraine during this invasion?
Of course. So when the war started, the first day, I got hundreds of messages from our local community, from chefs and food writers and culinary instructors, and they said, how can we help? And we decided hosting classes and pop-ups and dinners and fundraisers, whatever we could do. We just cook for people, and they bought tickets or they just send us donations, and we raised a ton of money. And then my publisher, like, I think it was the first week of war, and they called me and like, okay, you're doing a fundraiser for World Central Kitchen. We want to do something as well. Let's start pre-sailing the book. It's not ready yet. It's like still a few months to go, but let's start the pre-sale, and we will donate 20% from all the pre-sales to World Central Kitchen. And then our local bookstore contacted me, and they said, okay, we want to start pre-sailing as well, and we will donate money to this lovely lady who owns a cookbook store in Ukraine, and she helps Ukrainian people, so we'll send money to her. And that just like the whole community came together and stand with Ukraine, and it was such a magical moment for me because it was such a dark time, but people and from the culinary world and all over the place, from the United States, they just made it so much easier for me, and they helped so much.
Now, turning to the book Budmo, one thing I love about it is I think Ukrainian weather must be kind of like we have in Wisconsin, and agriculture is similar. A lot of the ingredients in Ukraine you can find pretty easily here in Wisconsin. Can you talk about some of the, I don't know, the distinctive features of Ukrainian cooking, the distinctive ingredients in particular?
Absolutely. So, of course, Ukraine has all four seasons. So we are very close to our land, so we follow the seasons. We preserve food in summer to have something exciting to eat in winter. And I grew up that way, so I grew up knowing where my food is coming from. And, of course, we had a small vegetable garden and a small fruit garden because we had a house, and my grandma had a house, not an apartment. And everybody in Ukraine owns a little bit of their own land. Or if they don't, they just go to to the farmer's market, which is bazaar, and they buy everything locally. And specifically our region, which is the south of Ukraine, is famous for the watermelons and melons, and I think the best tomatoes in the whole world. I just love them. And our ingredients are very, very understandable. We don't have like this exotic fruits. We don't have a lot of spices, and we don't have a lot of hot peppers. So everything is very familiar to the American audience, because we, of course, grow a lot of similar things, and potato that come from the United States, we just love it so much. We didn't have it in the 18th century, even in 19th century, but now it's such a central part of our cuisine. So I wanted to write a book where anyone can cook from, no matter the place, no matter the country, no matter the city. Everybody can go to a grocery store, get all the ingredients, and just start cooking from the book.
Anna Voloshina is with us on this edition of Food Friday. Her new cookbook is called Budmo, Recipes from a Ukrainian Kitchen. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for our guest about Ukrainian recipes, foods, ingredients, and culture. If you have a favorite dish from the Ukrainian cuisine to share with us, you could tell us about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. When we think about that region of the world, Anna, we might think about borscht, which it turns out comes in a lot of different colors and flavors. Can you tell us what is it that makes something borscht?
Okay, so borscht, despite like a lot of people might think borscht is all about beets, but it was not like that 300 years ago. Borscht is something very sour. The key component is the sour component. So in green borscht, it's actually sorrel. So it plays the main role. So something that has this wonderful combination of tangy and sweet, and it's very comforting, and it's kind of in between a stew and a soup. That's what borscht is. But now Ukrainian borscht, which we all know and love these days, it's mainly this very rich and luxurious soup with beets and tons of vegetables. And personally, I love it vegetarian, but my husband will disagree with me. He loves it with pork ribs. And you cannot define borscht in one sentence even. It's the whole culture. It's such an important dish for Ukrainian cuisine. We have songs about borscht. We have books about borscht and tales and poems. And every family in Ukraine will cook their own version of borscht. And I guarantee if you will go from one family to another, you will not taste two borscht that are alike.
We've got a recipe for that green sorrel borscht that Anna was talking about at WPR.org/Food Friday. Green sorrel, a springtime ingredient you can find if you look for it here in Wisconsin, often at farmers markets. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Brielle is with us in McFarland. Brielle, hi.
Hi.
You've got a question, I understand. What did you want to ask Anna?
My question is, what do kids love to eat in Ukraine?
Oh, interesting question. What is kid food for Ukrainian kids, Anna?
Oh, my God. I love this question. So my favorite food was, of course, Ukrainian vareniki, which you might know under another name, pierogi. So this is, I could eat every day, all day. They are the cutest little dumplings shaped as half moons. And they stuffed with a bunch of different stuff, so they can be sweet, they can be savory, and it was a whole ritual in our house to make those. And I remember when I was little, my job was to arrange those dumplings in a perfect rows, and then my grandma would just slide the cutting board with dumplings into her freezer. She would freeze them solid, and then any day I would ask for dumplings, she would just boil them from this frozen pieces, and they would taste exactly the same as fresh ones. And one of the favorite stuffings that all kids like are sour cherries. They are just amazing.
Brielle, thank you so much for calling in. You mentioned those dumplings. I grew up eating pierogi that my Polish grandma made. Is there a difference between those, that Polish version, and it's the Varenki in Ukrainian? Is there something that says, yeah, that's a pierogi, this is the Ukrainian style?
Yes, one tiny, tiny difference. They're basically twin brothers, but the only difference is we rarely fry our vareniki. So vareniki, the name comes from the word varity, which means to boil. So they basically boiled, and then when we are done enjoying them and the next day we want to reheat them, we will refry them on a pan. So this is it. I think this is the only difference. But the closer to you go in Ukraine to the Polish border, the more you will hear the name pierogi versus vareniki, and the more you will see them fried versus boiled. So I listened to one Polish culinary historian, and he said, we cannot say for sure who came up with those dumplings. We cannot say it's Polish. We cannot say it's 100% Ukrainian. So we just share this dish, and we are happy to share because Poland is such a great friend of Ukraine.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Anna Voloshina, Ukrainian-American chef, author of the new cookbook, Budmo, Recipes from a Ukrainian Kitchen. We're talking about Ukrainian cuisine, its importance in Ukrainian culture. You'll find a few of the recipes we talk about today online at wpr.org/foodfriday. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What Ukrainian dishes have you encountered, maybe tried to cook yourself? Do you have questions about what goes into Ukrainian cooking? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Anna Voloshina about her cookbook, Budmo, Recipes from a Ukrainian Kitchen. She's sharing recipes that have been passed down in her family and other dishes central to Ukrainian life. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your experiences eating, maybe making Ukrainian food. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Go back to your calls. Heather is with us in Brookfield. Hi, Heather.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about or bring up?
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to say just I used to live in Ukraine, and I was so amazed by how connected the cuisine was to the earth. And that was mentioned already, but it was just amazing the amount of produce during the summer and through fall. It was so delicious, the tomatoes and the cucumbers and lots of dill, just wonderful flavors. And I just wish I could replicate that here in the States. I love the dachas, and just there's so much produce, and the melons were delicious too. One question I had, I was visiting with a woman in Kiev, and it was in October, and she pulled out of her oven a pumpkin with almost like a rice casserole inside of it, and then she would kind of stir it up a little bit to get the meat of the pumpkin mixed with the rice. And I've tried to replicate that, and I could never get it.
So it was actually cooked in the pumpkin itself. The pumpkin itself is the vessel. Interesting, Heather. Anna, have you run into that?
Oh my God, yes! It is one of my favorite fall dishes. So first of all, in my book, I have a recipe for pumpkin kasha. Mm-hmm. Despite common opinion, kasha is not buckwheat. Kasha is just the name of a dish. It's like soup and kasha can be with rice. So I have the recipe with pumpkin kasha, but I also made another kasha not with rice, but with millet. And it's like more traditional in Ukraine, inside a pumpkin. So you can totally make it happen. You just need to make sure you roast it in a low oven. You need to soak your rice overnight and then use the best full fat milk, a little bit of raisins, vanilla, and this is it. And you basically stir it all together, stuff it inside the pumpkin, and roast it in a 300 oven for a couple of hours, maybe up to 3 hours. And then once you are able to pierce the pumpkin with a knife, this is it. This is ready, and taste your rice. It needs to be cooked through, but in 3 hours it will be cooked. And then you just mix the flesh and the kasha together, and it will be the most luxurious dish you've ever made.
Heather, thanks for the call. Now you just have to wait for pumpkin season. Anna, I would guess that we're going to be best off using a smaller, like, baking pumpkin as opposed to our giant Halloween pumpkins.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, for sure. Yes. Try to find the one that it actually has a lot of flavor. So some sugar pumpkins, small pumpkins. Just make two or three, but the smaller will cook faster.
Thanks again for that call, Heather. Susan is with us now in Milwaukee. Susan, hello.
Hello there.
What did you want to tell us about?
I just am delighted to hear her, and I'm hoping that my cousin and his wife might possibly be listening. I know that they are also fans of public radio. In the midst of the COVID, my 99-year-old aunt died of COVID, based on neglect of people who were working around her, not wearing masks, not being vaccinated in the central part of Wisconsin. But there stood this big old house, the family house on the farm, and my cousin and his wife still live on the farm, and they just have moved heaven and earth and were determined to find a family from Ukraine to move here and to live in that home. And so they did a GoFundMe, and they have them, it's a man and wife and two children, and the last I heard, they were getting the children enrolled in school and in preschool, and they're taking English lessons, and they're getting jobs, and the thing filled with is American food, and of course, my cousin and his wife are enjoying Ukrainian food as well. I just thought that
wonderful. Susan, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Were there, in that position, Anna, were there adaptations you had to make in the U.S. to, what you used to be able to cook in Ukraine?
Oh, absolutely. When I came here, I didn't know anything, of course. And my husband's coworkers, they decided to show us everything, and they brought us to Safeway, and I almost left crying because I saw those pale tomatoes, and the food cost was so high, and the produce was not good, and I thought, okay, this is it, this is my life now. And then the next week I discovered a farmer's market, which was just a couple of blocks away from the place we lived. And it was the most joyous moment because the produce there was so amazing. And I feel like this is the main problem, is to find good produce. And I feel like we are very spoiled in the Bay Area because we have everything there, and the quality is superb. And it very much reminds me of the produce in Ukraine. So the only thing is, like, I had to start being very conscious with my choices, and then I started making my own sour cream and my own cheese at home, everything that we use in Ukrainian cooking, and the quality here is not the same, or I cannot find the produce. I would just make it myself. I make my own kefir, I make basically everything dairy I can transform into some product from Ukraine. And other than that, I don't miss anything, because we have amazing bread in San Francisco, and it just took time to learn everything and to find my farmers.
We are talking to Anna Voloshina, Ukrainian-American chef. Her new cookbook is called Budmo, Recipes from a Ukrainian Kitchen. We heard from Joan in Racine, who says her ancestors are from Crimea. Joan's mom used to make a fresh green bean soup with bacon, vinegar, and potatoes in the summer. And Joan wants to know if that's, from Crimea or Ukraine or elsewhere. I know sometimes, Anna, like with the pierogies, it can be hard to tell where they started from.
Oh, with this one, it's definitely not Ukrainian. I would say this is Tatar, because Crimean population was very much consisting of Tatars before USSR moved them to Siberia. And then after the USSR collapsed, they were able to come back to Crimea, to Ukraine, and they brought their dishes with them. So this is not 100% Ukrainian dish. I think it's mostly Tatar slash Turkish Greek influence. And we love it in Ukraine, but I wouldn't say we own this recipe.
And that reminds me, you refer to yourself as a recipe detective. Could you tell us a little bit about your investigations to try to find different recipes and their origins?
Yes, because right now, especially after the war, Ukraine wants to rediscover its culinary identity, because for 70 plus years since the Soviet Union dragged us into that whole story, we almost lost our culinary culture, because the goal of USSR was to make every republic identical. And they tried to erase the identity of other nations by erasing their recipes and their dishes and forming this one blend cuisine with different dishes from all over the world. And we lost a lot of our history. We lost a lot of our books, and we were not allowed to write cookbooks in Ukrainian. So right now, a lot of chefs and a lot of culinary writers, they are digging very deep to discover what was an actual Ukrainian cuisine before the USSR and before it was heavily influenced by that nonsense.
Anna, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
That's Anna Voloshina, author of the new cookbook, Budmo, Recipes from a Ukrainian Kitchen. She joined us on Food Friday to share flavors from her native country, as well as recipes you'll find in her new cookbook. And we've got a few of them online at WPR.org/Food Friday. We mentioned that green sorrel borscht. We've also got, these look great, beet pickled deviled eggs. A beautiful color, too, from those beets. And Grandma's Roasted Duck, something to celebrate with. Find those recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. You can keep sharing your own experiences, maybe, with Ukrainian food on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, check out the latest sleep research. Find out how we can get better sleep. That's very useful. And why it's so good for our health to get good rest on a regular basis. Join that conversation. It's coming up Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, some old books are getting some new language. Works by British authors Roald Dahl and Ian Fleming are seeing new editions published that either remove, reword, or otherwise revise words or sentences that might be offensive. While the efforts aren't about banning James and the Giant Peach or James Bond, it brings up the question of whether or not texts like this should be updated and how doing so affects current readers and future readers. And it comes at a time when many books are being removed from shelves in libraries and schools because of ideological opposition to their content. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this? Publishers, copyright holders, moves to revise Roald Dahl and Ian Fleming books for a more modern audience? Do you think they should stay as they were written? Is it worth updating them for newer audiences? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Adam Lotz is a professor of education and history at Binghamton University in New York, author of the book The Other School Reformers, Conservative Activism in American Education. He was a middle school and high school teacher in Milwaukee for 10 years and got his PhD at UW-Madison. Adam, welcome to Central Time and welcome back to Wisconsin.
Hi, thank you. It's great to be back.
Well, let's look at what we know about what the owners of these properties, these books, are doing to change things, starting with Roald Dahl. Now, he's got a lot of legendary kids' books, the Charlie and Chocolate Factory, things like that. What do you see as the nature of the changes that they're looking at making there?
Well, from what I've seen, they're changing language to make it less offensive. So, for example, the Roald Dahl changes seem to be a lot of, like, really sexist and pretty angry language in some of the originals, you know. So, for example, referring to older women as old hags, you know, they're taking that language out. Instead of referring to a woman as maybe being a secretary, they're referring to her as being a successful executive. You know, so they're taking out some of the sexist language, and also some of the racially loaded stuff. So, you know, these characters, for example, in earlier editions, are being rebranded as, you know, just people of shorter stature, you know, that kind of thing.
What do you think? Let's stay with Roald Dahl for a minute. What do you think about this idea of releasing a new version of these books, but changing the language in ways that, you know, might, I don't know, might be less offensive, might be more sensitive to people's needs?
Well, I think it's the worst possible approach to this kind of situation. And it's both as a teacher and as a citizen and as a historian, it seems like this move by the person who the company that owns the copyright, it seems like it picked an unnecessarily worst case scenario for how to address these problems. So, for example, one thing people could do if a book is old and its language is offensive and angry and derogatory, full of derogatory stereotypes, you know, the book could just fade out. And obviously the owners didn't want to do that. The owners of the copyright didn't want to do that. The second thing, if it's a great work of literature, or maybe like you said, it's like a legendary book that people want to keep for their generations for sentimental reasons, you give it context. You explain to new readers where this language comes from and why it was used at the time and why it's offensive and why we don't use it anymore. But they did instead of doing either of those things, instead of making it a chance for kids to learn about both the story and where it comes from, they just sort of slapped a smiley face sticker over it. And that doesn't help. That ruins the book, and it blocks the kids who are reading the book from knowing where any of this came from or what the problem was in the first place. So in my opinion, it's the worst possible way to go.
And then we've got Ian Fleming. Now, this is the James Bond author. He wrote many books about the legendary fictional spy. Changing some of the descriptions, especially of characters of color. And I understand Ian Fleming had done this himself for one of his books. And now his estate is saying, in effect, we're picking up where he left off as we republish these. Do you have a similar reaction?
Similar, but they even seem to have done a worse job. You know, so for example, the new edits, they take some things out that are, you know, offensive and derogatory, but they leave some things in. Like famously, you know, if you remember the Sean Connery mm-hmm. era, the old James Bond was not just winking, but sort of smiling at sexual violence. And the new editions, quote unquote new, because they left some of that, in my opinion, the most offensive stuff, they left it in. So they tried to do a bad solution, and it seems like they didn't even do a very good job of it.
I want to look into why this is happening a little bit. Now, when you see the headlines about this, you might think, oh, you know, maybe an angry group gathered in person in front of the publisher's headquarters, or an online mob or something like this. The Roald Dahl, now Netflix has the rights to a lot of this, and it looks like they're creating a Roald Dahl cinematic universe, basically. So a lot of money at stake here for them. And of course, the James Bond movie franchise has made lots and lots of money. These are people who own the rights to a license to print money. Why do you think they are the ones driving this kind of change?
Well, I mean, I think the reasons are obvious. And honestly, I think the desire to keep a title relevant and to keep it profitable is a whole different category from even, you know, conservative parents who are concerned about some of the titles that their kids will be reading. And they're concerned because they care about their kids. Like, I may disagree with a lot of that, as I do. I don't think books, you know, like Entango Makes Three, you know, the Penguin book. Mm-hmm. I don't think books like that should be kept from children. I think children should have access to them. But I sympathize when parents and teachers are concerned if certain topics and ideas are appropriate for their kids. At least we're all concerned about the kids. This is just a concern for maximum profitability. So I really think it deserves to be in its own category.
We're talking to Adam Lotz, professor of education and history at Binghamton University, looking at new editions, slightly revised editions of Roald Dahl, books for kids, Ian Fleming, books about James Bond. Changing some of the language aimed at making it less offensive. Again, some money at stake at both properties. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Pat is with us in Green Bay. Pat, hi. What do you think?
okay, when you guys started this conversation, I had all I could do from going from screaming like you got to be kidding me to just laughing. This has gotten, we have gone to such an extreme of, oh, heaven forbid we can't offend somebody. You have to look at the time period when these books were written, when these movies were made. Okay? It's how it was. You can't change history. And to sit here and, oh, we have to cleanse all of this stuff. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm a construction worker. We leave our feelings at home. And if somebody's feelings got hurt, oh, well, they'll get over it.
Pat,
is what it is.
Pat, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Adam, what do you think?
Well, hi, Pat. Thanks for the call. Go Packers. I don't agree that we shouldn't. Like, I think we should. We do as a society need to be careful and need to be paying attention to what especially children are reading and exposed to. I don't think that it's going too far to be worried about what kids will be seeing. And if there are old books, not just Roald Dahl, not just Ian Fleming, but, you know, Mark Twain and Of Mice and Men is the other one that often gets criticized for having, you know, racial language that's really derogatory in it. I think it's wise for us, whatever our politics, to be paying attention to what children are reading. And if there are books out there that have, negative depictions of women or of conservatives, we need to look at that and say, hey, is it worth it? Is this book so fantastic? Is it so important? Is this movie so vital to kids understanding history that we want them to see it and we want to help them understand it? Like Pat said, it is how things were in the past and kids should understand that. So just doing what the Roald Dahl owners did and just kind of taking parts out as if they never existed, that's bad. Some books really should be read even with the offensive content. I agree, but students need guidance. They need to understand why Mark Twain used that N-word so much if they're going to read it. They can't just be left on their own, and if it hurts them, too bad. That's too harsh. That's not what we want for our children.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Adam Lotz, professor of education and history at Binghamton University, former teacher in Milwaukee middle school and high schools, about recent news about revised editions of books by Roald Dahl and Ian Fleming. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest? Are you a student, parent, teacher, a librarian? What are your thoughts on, you know, changing these books retroactively to take out some things that are offensive? If you work with material with kids that, yeah, it's older stuff, there's some bad stuff in it, how do you deal with that? How do you talk to that reader? How do you explain what's different from then to now? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Adam Lotz, professor of education and history at Binghamton University and former Milwaukee teacher. Talk about issues of literary censorship and updating for relevance after the news that publishers are updating books by Roald Dahl. He's the James the Giant Peach author, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and Ian Fleming, that's the James Bond author, to remove or revise what's now seen as offensive content. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Chris is with us in Fairchild. Hi, Chris.
Howdy, sir. Say, I'm listening to the conversation here, and whereas I do agree with the guest that removing language is not necessarily the right answer. Again, these things are being removed from private pieces of work. They're owned by a private company. The publisher is doing this, not necessarily the artist, if you will. And they're in business to make money, so they're going to do whatever they have to do to sell the most product. So it's not really for a benefit of anybody, but if they think it's going to sell more product, sure, they're going to remove language.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Adam, yeah, I don't think there's any argument. If they hold the copyrights, they can do what they want with it with the intention of making money. I think you're just not happy with the outcome.
Well, sure. Yeah, and it's a great point, Chris. But I think that there's two elements that make it a bigger question. The one is that I think there's an implication that the company or the copyright owners are feeling some sort of pressure to change this. And I think there are people who find that pressure a shame, who say books like James and the Giant Peach should be free to use the language that was, you know, from the time that they were written, and that it's a travesty that the publishers should feel the pressure. And right, it's just market pressure. But some people feel it's a shame, worse than a shame, that they should have to change what people view as a classic children's book because of excessive sensitivity toward current norms. I don't agree, but I think that's the issue more than just can a private company change one of its properties. I think most people agree with that.
Thanks a lot for that call. Mike joins us next in Waukesha. Mike, hello.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Mike?
Well, I heard the construction worker earlier, and he brought up a point that this is all in the past. But what's going on as we speak is unbelievably offensive language that kids that you're talking about are hearing or reading things like Mark Twain or this, that, and the next thing, with which may or may not have the N-word in it. And how do you differentiate that they might be reading it in a book, which I highly doubt, as opposed to hearing it at home on some of the obscenely offensive songs that are out right now, and that you want to take away an American classic like Mark Twain and edit it and leave everything else out there?
I gotcha. Mike, thanks for the call. So distinguishing, I guess, between a music that might contain offensive words versus a book that we might teach in school. Adam, do you have a line you'd want to draw for Mike?
Well, I do. It's a great point. Especially, we don't just have to say songs. You know, when school districts or governors or, ambitious pundits say that, this book or that book should be banned, it's hard for anyone. You don't have to be a middle school or a high school teacher to point out that every adolescent has the internet in their pocket right now at all times. It's not books that they're mostly looking at. It's TikTok and other media. So sure, I think Mike makes a great point. Why are we obsessing about books? I think one of the reasons, the good reasons, in my opinion, it's not just that this information is out there. We're talking about books in most cases, maybe not James Bond, but these other ones that are being given to kids at school. And I think that's part of the problem. It's books that seem to be, like Mark Twain was a great example. A book that comes from a teacher or from a library seems to have a different status, even to children, than just some random, internet content that they see or that someone, sends them or whatever. So I do think it is a different thing and a more important conversation to talk about things that are part of library collections and school content. The biggest problem, in my opinion, is that it's a conversation that's difficult to have. Does a particular work of art merit inclusion in a school library or classroom? We need to have a sensitive, open conversation. When the politics get to be the way they do, that's exactly what we can't have.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mike. We're talking to Adam Lotz from Binghamton University, professor of education and history there, former teacher here in Wisconsin, looking at changes in new editions by a couple of well-known authors, Roald Dahl and Ian Fleming, taking out offensive content from the original works when they are republished. Let's bring on another caller now. Bob is with us in Madison. Bob, hello.
Hello. I want to bring up two specific authors that I know have had revisions both physically in their books and in a lot of their audiobooks. I'm a tremendous fan of H.P. Lovecraft and Robert E. Howard. And they have unfortunately been outspokenly kind of, well, colorful in their language. But it's one of those aspects of seeing their works revised just in the slightest way when it had no real negative connotation necessarily to the story that was being portrayed. It just seems like it's editing down something that, and I agree, I forget what the guy's name was, but he's the construction worker. It was a sign of the times. And it does bring up to me that, like, if we don't remember that language like that was used, terms like that were used, that they'll get reused. Like, again, history will repeat itself.
Bob, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. I remember reading H.P. Lovecraft, and the N-word pops up in one story that I remember kind of surprisingly. Adam, the approach, if I'm hearing you right, wouldn't be to take that out, but maybe have some kind of, like, introduction, putting it into context.
Right. And I was also, when I was younger, a big fan of H.P. Lovecraft, and I remember wondering about it. With that book, kind of like Roald Dahl, kind of like Ian Fleming, I never read that. I think they're sort of sideways, on the side of school curriculum. Mm-hmm. So I think the question we need to have with any book, H.P. Lovecraft is a good example. Is this a powerful enough piece of literature for social reasons, for historical reasons, for literary reasons, for aesthetic reasons, that we want to help kids understand why the language is so offensive and angry? And Lovecraft really was, it was the universe was very stacked racially in those books.
Mm-hmm. Bob, thanks a lot for that call. Adam, you've highlighted the tension between kind of our political conversation about what books kids have access to in libraries and in schools, and maybe a more productive way of talking about it. How do we get from that very angry version to a more productive conversation that puts the interests of kids at the middle of it?
Yeah, well, the good news is that we're doing it every day, and you wouldn't necessarily get that if you just looked at Twitter and the newspapers. But these are conversations that parents, librarians, teachers have been having forever. Do you think a specific family might have an objection to a book that a school uses in its curriculum, in its English classes? And almost always they talk about it and they just work it out, because the good news is that, families trust their teachers. So when the Gallup organization asks American parents, how are schools doing? Huge majority of people say, schools are terrible. But then when they ask a follow-up, how are your kids' schools? Huge majorities of parents say, my kids' schools are great. My kids' teachers are great. We trust them. And we have conversations like this all the time. And that's what we need to focus on. We all want the best for our kids.
Adam, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Adam Lotz, professor of education and history at Binghamton University, author of the book, The Other School Reformers, Conservative Activism in American Education. We talked to him today about the past and present of book revisions in the United States and how parents, educators, and librarians can make decisions about what to share with and teach young readers. This after new editions coming out of Roald Dahl, the children's book author, Ian Fleming, the James Bond author, the copyright holders putting out new editions with some changes geared at making parts of them, they hope, less offensive and more purchasable. You can keep sharing your thoughts on the issue. You can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org.